welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are in your ears, thanks to the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Well, that cup fever just turned out to be a nasty little sniffle as a last-gasp defensive lapse saw Leicester progress to the quarterfinals at our expense. It was a much-changed team that took on the Foxes after a very leggy display at Burnley saw us come away from Turf Moor with just a point. Today, we welcome Aston Villa to the Amex, who had a full week to prepare, which is almost unheard of in these COVID times. The Villas have also been in good form of late and will be hungry to avenge their defeat back in November. In other news, the Albion women's team caused a massive shock by beating Chelsea on their own patch and inflicting their first defeat in 33 games. They then followed that up with a win over West Ham to ease their relegation fears. Joining us to discuss all of that and more is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back a man who loves a conundrum. It's Steve Agass. And we also welcome back the man with the fastest little legs in football. It's the former Albion physio, Malcolm Stewart. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
Lovely to see you.
Hello.
We got there eventually. I mean, just to let some daylight in upon magic, we had a few Zoom nightmares this evening, and but we got there in the end, and it's lovely to see your lovely, smiling, happy faces, everyone.
Oh, the wonders of modern technology. Don't even go there. There's my emails have conked out, and Zoom wouldn't work properly. Malcolm doesn't know which one is the volume button. Steve's just going to show off. So
he can fix a player, but not a computer.
Listen up, we've lost entire shows by turning up at the Radio Reverb studios and the power being conked out, or someone's vandalised it, or the studio's not ready. So in the great scheme of things, and given sort of like the citizen journalism that we have with this, I think we're doing a pretty reasonable job.
Okay, but Malcolm, let's start with you. Firstly, it's lovely to see you. How's it been for you with the whole COVID lockdown and stuff? Because I mean, I know that you're still working and keeping your oar in with your physio stuff, which must be a nightmare in this times.
Well, actually, the physio stuff had to go. We've closed the clinic down. Fortunately, I'm still involved with the FA, so football wise, I've been busier than ever. Managed to take in a lot of games, AD. Been to a lot of training grounds, so yeah, it's been quite good for me.
Okay, and Steve, is since the last time we saw you, your countdown episode has been repeated. could you just remind us how you got on?
I was somewhat surprised to win three episodes, which was fantastic, and met the lovely Rachel. And lost in the fourth episode to a guy that ended up being an octo champ, so can't be too disappointed, I guess.
Well, I would like to point out that the trophy that is behind Steve's head as we're looking at him is not the countdown trophy, but it is in fact the Renf quiz trophy, which you won.
Steve was first on about a year ago, and we were talking about countdown and how he's a TV. Does this mean you're going to be going to House of Games and Tipping Point and Pointless and what have you then, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, the plan is the Renf team, the Queen's Park Strangers, are going to be going on to Family Fortunes very soon. And we're also doing the football charity kind of quiz open in Monaco in the summer. We'll be appearing there. I think this is it. I think the Roar is kind of the height of my media fame.
There's higher planes to achieve here, mate.
He's reached the pinnacle.
But no, Steve was on about this time last year and had never taken part in the Robert Eaton Memorial Fun Quiz. And we've done, about 10 now. So you turn up for the first time and tell our listener what happened.
AD said, you've got to go on. AD and Al, you both said, look, you've got to get a team together. And don't know whether you guys know, but the listeners might not, that I work in recruitment. So the first thing I did was think about how would I approach this from a recruitment perspective. So I contacted every very clever person I know, built a team, answered very little myself, and won the quiz. So
I'm calling that cheating. I'm calling
that. That's the way to go.
I mean, come on, we've got Jack Grealish coming to the Amex this weekend. No more cheating. Come on.
Aidy, remind me, how many times have you won it?
I've only won it once, but we've come second three times. But,
and even then, when you won it on a tie break, didn't you? It was on a tie break. And just how gracious were you as a winner?
Look, we just beat the Mastermind champion. Come on, give me a break here.
He went dancing around Dick's bar like there was no tomorrow. The most ungracious winner I've ever seen.
I'm not going to deny that I celebrated like we just scored the winning goal in an FA Cup final or something, which we won't be in this year, which we'll come to in a second. But
yeah, I can't believe he's finished second three times and he sets the questions.
Oh, no, I don't set the questions.
Okay, I do love swiftly. The way that Malcolm confuses you and me, Aidy. I mean, actually, that's terrible. How dare you, Malcolm?
Yeah, well, anyway, let's move swiftly on. We went to Burnley last Saturday, and I mean, let's face it, guys. I mean, it was very much a game after the Lord Mayor show, after the brilliant wins at Anfield and beating Spurs. And it was a very, very, very leggy performance, wasn't it?
Yeah. The lads looked tired. I mean, there's a lot of travelling involved. It's not just the training and the games, the travelling. And I think not just physically, but I think mentally, they looked perhaps a little bit jaded.
Yeah, I
Malcolm,
mean... Sorry, go on, Steve.
I just wondered, Malcolm, would the Albion... You know, in this day and age of Premier League football, would they have stayed in the north, or would they have come back and then gone back up?
No, they would have come back because, unfortunately, the COVID restrictions, I think, at the moment, detail that they have to. So, the ideal thing would have been to have stayed up there, but no, they would have to have come back.
Yeah, and the other thing you have to, and as you correctly said, Malcolm, because I mean, obviously coming back from Liverpool, I mean, it was a late kickoff. They wouldn't have got back home until probably about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then they'd probably come in and do some recovery that day.
Exactly, the recovery sessions. I mean, at the moment, I don't think teams can actually train. It's all about recovery. It's travel, recovery. Back out for the next game. It must be extremely difficult at the moment for managers and coaches. They can't actually do their job physically.
Yeah, I mean, Mal, I said at the top of the show that that we're welcoming Villa to the Amex this week, and they got knocked out of the FA Cup, so they've had a full week to recover. I mean, is that a massive advantage?
Yeah, it is. It is. Just the fact you can get on the training ground and work with the players. How can Brighton get the ideas over? I mean, we know how Villa play. We know their set pieces. Very difficult to input it in possibly what one day. Villa will have a week, you know, looking at us, how we play. So, yeah, it does give them a big advantage.
But would it be the case, though, that given that I think it's going to be fairly obvious, and I suspect he'd made his mind up a few days before, that... we're effectively talking about two first 11s here, of which there is some crossover. So we've had our game against Burnley, and then he's got this first team game against Leicester coming up in the FA Cup, and he knows he's got Aston Villa. And obviously he's clearly targeting the Premier League as the one to stay in, and the FA Cup is a little bit of a sort of a bonus, a free hit. So with the training, would it be the case also that he'd have had two different lots of first 11s, effectively the Premier League first 11 training in, or the first... I don't know, 15 training in one section, and the team that he knows he was going to face against the Leicester, in another session, or is that just sort of like, you know, too fanciful to consider that actually, you know, the players are going to still be able to get their full, you know, sort of week's preparation in.
Yeah, I think you'll find that some of the players that did play against Leicester will also be involved against Villa. So not all of them could have. Some of them have been given a break. And as I said, that will freshen them up mentally. It was quite... you're looking defensively, and it seemed that he played more defenders that I think will figure than he did midfield players and front players. So I think we'll be fresher in the energy departments. But again, didn't have time to work with them because the coaching staff were involved in the Leicester game, so they can't... Mm-hmm. Okay. Be with both.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually disagree with you as well, Al, because when we saw the team, and we whispered it because we didn't want to jinx it, but we actually thought it was actually a pretty decent team, and it was a team that we wanted to see. And there was a few players. We're going to talk about that one in a second. But are you suggesting that Lewis Dunk is now a second team player, Al? Because it's not.
No, not at all. I mean, I did say at the beginning of what I was saying is there was some crossover. There were some of the first 11 that still carried on playing. And to be honest, we don't actually have, weirdly enough, if we're going to have a back five or certainly a back three, our strength and depth isn't that great. We've got Dunk, we've got White, we've got Byrne, we've got Webster. And after that, you're then into the kids.
And Veltman.
Veltman, yes, nominally, I still consider him a right back. He's a little bit untried and untested as a centre back in this country, but
internationally, that's where he plays for Holland. So,
okay, but I would suggest that, you know, like I say that we're a little thinner on the ground with just because of the number of defenders we play compared to the number of midfielders, and we made, you know, we had two debutants, the two Polish guys, and that's what I mean about, you know, those guys are. Unless something horrific happens, there's an awful lot of traffic ahead of them for them to get into the Premier League side. But it gave the certain midfield players that rest that they needed. You know, I mean, if Assuma's going to play 20 minutes, I think that's okay. You just don't want to go him going hell for leather for 90 minutes. That's what's going to tire him out.
Okay, well, if we're talking about that Leicester game, then I mean, I was surprised that Bissouma was even brought on in that big game. I mean, with 15, 20 minutes left, then why are we bringing on... I mean, Alexis McAllister for Lallana, I can understand, but I don't understand taking...
Because the game was still there to be won, I think.
Exactly. You've got Welbeck, you've got Connolly, you've got Morpay on the bench. If the game's still there to be won, surely you wouldn't go... That's a defensive substitution.
Zakaria was playing very, very well. I actually thought, I don't know about you, Steve, but I thought Zakaria was one of our better players.
Yeah, I was, I have to say, I was the only disappointment I had before the game when I was texting a couple of mates was potentially Zakaria up front looked the weak link. And actually, I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah,
he looked really threatening. And I was really pleasantly surprised. I thought he did really well. Malcolm, I just wondered. Mm-hmm. With the lack of defensive changes, is it the case that centre-halves generally do less physical work and therefore are more likely to be able to play more games in a week? And I also wondered whether, you know what you were saying about the lack of ability to train, are the team thinking, well, to give Bissouma half an hour is essentially a case of keeping him sharp because he isn't actually able to train in between matches?
Would have. Probably use that as a training session. Yeah, you're quite right. Bring him on. As I said, you've got your energy areas. You look at your pace, probably your midfield and front players. Don't associate that sharpness all over the pitch. And often, I think, the defenders are much more like, as they turn around and say, you know, the cart horse is the side. And as I said, this season, if you look, we've quite often used the same defence throughout the FA Cup when we've made various changes. Funny enough, one of the things that we used to do, if you take into account the distance covered throughout a game, midfield players quite high, but so are defenders, because basically set pieces, defenders are constantly up and down the pitch. Mm-hmm. Now, though it's not explosive, still cover quite a distance. But equally, I think you'll find that defenders, they tend to want to play. What surprised me a little bit, and I know that we've got to give the goalkeeper a game, but you've just brought a young keeper in, I think, is doing exceptionally well. And I thought to keep them together, use the centre-halves and the goalkeeper, keeps that unit the same, because I think that's where you get your strength when they get to know one another. And I thought actually that against Burnley, I thought that was really coming to the fore, that the goalkeeper and the defenders were really getting used to one another.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about the direction of travel on this show before, and the fact that we are heading in the right direction, and we're just a real prolific striker away from challenging in the other half of the table, I think, at the moment. And it's very much a work in progress, Steve, isn't it? Because I mean, we seem to have sorted out the defensive lapses, apart from the one again the last minute against Leicester. We'll come to that in a bit. I mean, that was just, oh my God, I'm still.
It's the original question, AD.
But I mean, we seem to have sorted out that the midfield seems to be he's got McAllister being probably our most crucial player at the moment. I think him and Bissouma are absolutely wonderful in the centre of the park. Then Moda came in and looked absolutely brilliant as well. But it's just that at the sharp end of the pitch that we're seriously lacking at the moment. And this is Potter's plan, isn't it? To gradually progress the side. And I think that's the next area that's in need of attention.
If you look at the squad, in terms of the depth, suddenly, so weirdly enough, the last time I was on the Raw was after the Sheffield Wednesday game last year.
Yeah,
and I had a little sneak at the team that we played in that game. And believe it or not, we actually played the same formation, because we very much think of that as a new formation for Potter this season, or the tail end of last season. But we actually played three at the back and two wing backs. And on that day, to give you an idea of how much we progressed, it was Bong and Schelotto. When you look at the caliber of the wing backs we have now in the squad, to bring in Karbalnik and Alzat played there, didn't he? But Alzat would be what, the fourth choice in a wing back role if everyone was fit, maybe a third choice. The depth suddenly is astonishing, isn't it? And Moda looked, I thought, fantastic. Looked like a real Rolls Royce of a player. The quality in the team is suddenly on another level, I think.
Okay. Malcolm?
I think that's certainly right. And do you know what? What I like about this, this side's evolving, and so is the manager. You know, the second season in any league is a difficult season. This is only his second season as a manager in the Premiership. And I think he, along with the side, is evolving. And I see things being very, very bright in the future. Very bright indeed.
I mean, considering the managers that you've worked under, and we're going back to, you know, the black and white days of Glenn Wilson here, probably, but give us a quick overall appraisal of where you think Graham Potter stands within the sort of like the room of Albion managers.
I think that one of the best managers I worked with was Steve Cockle, and I think that. I think Graham Potter's along those levels is very much a thinker. Once said to Steve Cockle, you know, you've never once raised your voice at half time or after the end of the game. And he said, no point. He said, at half time, I've got 15 minutes to get my side over to them. And at the end of the game, I can't change anything. And I do see Graham Potter being very, very similar. His work is on the training pitch and match days. No point jumping up and down because, you know, you've got the side set out. I think a very, you know, very bright future, a very bright manager.
Yeah, he really is. Actually, I mean, we talk about jumping up and down. I don't know if anyone saw Carlo Ancelotti's reaction to them, like going 5-4 up this week.
Yeah, very much so.
we've just gone 5-4 up in extra time, and all he did was just blow his coffee.
Who's got the wildest celebrations, Potter or Houghton?
Exactly. but, you know, Chris was another manager that very much realised where his job was. His job was, you know, prior to the game. Do you know what? I've always thought, and you're probably the same, it's different now in an empty stadium. But in a full stadium, when you see managers up shouting, do you think players actually hear them? Do you think players react? I don't. But it's a little bit different now in an empty stadium.
The person you hear mostly is Adam Lallana.
Okay.
Yeah, true.
And that was a question. Go on.
No, carry on. That's where your leaders are. Your leaders are on the pitch. That's where you want them, you know, match days on the pitch.
Yeah, Adam Lallana does that even when he's not on the pitch, actually. But he's very, very vocal.
Lallana and Webster are the biggest ones. I mean, I see Lewis Dunk as a leader, and I know that in the past, AD, you've criticised him as Lewis Dunk as not being the textbook typical leader. In as much for me, he's not a baller. He's not someone who he leads by example. I mean, don't get me wrong. Lallana leads by example. Webster leads by encouragement, for instance. And I think will be an excellent Albion captain or stand-in captain to Dunk. Lallana, like you say, I mean, you know, he probably frightens the tugboatmen off the marina by the time he shouts. But Dunk, I think you don't. I mean, there is that consideration that you don't have to be a baller to be a leader.
Mel? Absolutely.
Potter's another example, isn't he? Again, like you say.
Exactly. Yeah,
although Potter, it was interesting to see he started heading every ball, isn't he, Potter, now? When you see him on the touchline, every time there's a cross, he's going in, isn't he?
I think that's his new mod haircut, and him actually trying to dance, I think. But, I mean, you mentioned Lewis Dunk there, so let's talk about his goal at Burnley. It was actually a corner from Pascal Gross, and that was actually his... sixth assist of the season in all competitions, which is fantastic. Which basically, and Graham's basically said this week that this is the best that he's actually seen Pascal play for the Albion since he's been there.
Well, it's the best I've seen him play. I mean, for the fact he got player of the season, I think it was his stats that got him over the line in that first season in the Premier League. I didn't vote for him in that. I thought that there were other players who were better, but it seemed to be the stats that got him over the line. But Steve, you know, I think that the Potter's right. In those 4 years or 3.5 years that we've been in the Premier League, this is probably the best we've seen from Pascal Gross. And frankly, about time, isn't it?
I think year one, I thought he was excellent, season one. So this is his fourth season, right, with us. So it was Houghton 1 and 2 and then Potter 1 and 2. Yeah. Season one, I thought he was terrific. I mean, he scored the... Was it the first goal in the Premier League for us? The goal against he was the match winner in that game, wasn't he? And I think he got six goals and seven assists or something season one.
Yeah.
But then he just seemed to really go off the boil and it looked like he was on his way out, didn't it, really? I mean, no one would have been surprised if he'd have moved on, but he's another one that I think Potter's improved.
Sorry, I was going to say, the irony is that for the fact that with Graham Potter, pace is key, Pascal Gross, I've seen yogurt turn quicker.
Yogurt doesn't Cruyff turn out.
To be fair, I think it's, again, you know, it's who he's playing with, and I think that Basuma should take a lot of the credit for the way that Gross is playing, without a doubt. They two of them seem to have an understanding. Basuma's doing the work defensively, allowing Gross to go forward and create. You know, it's a matter of sometimes getting your pairings right all over the pitch, and I think he's got this one spot on.
Do you know what? That's a really good point, because also last season there was a period where Gross was playing in central midfield and he looked really paceless and awful. This season he plays in central midfield, and because Basuma's doing that work, he looks terrific.
Yeah, absolutely.
And don't forget, you've also got Alexis McAllister in there as well, who he is the... Like, I think he's our most important player at the moment. He's box to box. I mean, Basuma is obviously as important, probably, but at the sharp end, and doing, he is just linking everything. And I was watching the highlights of the Burnley game again today, and there was a couple of instances. Aaron Connolly was absolutely desperate to score, wasn't he?
He always is.
He wanted to get on the score, and he got very close. That effort that was brilliantly saved by Pope. But every time he was getting through, and he's getting through those chances, you saw Alexis McAllister was up there with him looking for the pass.
For me, Alexis McAllister is the ultimate cautionary tale about how people judge players as soon as they arrive. I mean, he was on loan back in Argentina. He turned up at our place and he had a couple of, you know, good cameos. I think he was involved in the Arsenal winner, or the winner against Arsenal. And he looked okay. And then he sort of faded in certain games. He looks a totally different player. You know, we've had Brian on and Owen on the show, the Argus reporter who knows the McAllister family. They're a footballing family, and they're very proud of how he's come out, of how he's coming along. And he is just that thing of people must be patient and consider that, you know, it's a different culture, it's a different consideration, it's a different style of game, it's a different everything. And if we can be patient and not put pressure on a given player, and in this particular instance, I'm thinking of someone who is only two or three games into his Albion career, Percy Tau, the great hope of, you know, this incredible South African footballer who's going to turn us around. He's not quite at the races yet, but if anyone criticises him for that, then they're doing so very, very prejudicially and very far too quickly. Because, you know, McAllister is that cautionary tale that says, be patient.
Steve?
I was just going to say, I think that what's changed with McAllister and where he's developed, from what I saw, especially in the Spurs game, is he's a player that trades in space. You need, if you give him space, you'll hurt teams. And it looked to me in the Spurs game, what tended to happen was for the goal, he played the ball out wide and everyone else dropped back. So Spurs to defend and Brighton were attacking. And he just sat in that space and waited for the pass back to him. Those pockets of space are essentially what where you get a player like McAllister really hurting teams. And I think he's had to learn to adapt to English football and the pace of English football to pick up that space. And I think he's doing that really, really well.
Now, Malcolm, I mean, the game's changed dramatically since you were working at the club mainly. But I mean, and obviously there's a lot more imports from abroad coming over. But I mean, one player that really shone for the Albion in his short cameo was Sergei Gotsmanov, who you would have worked with.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, Al talked about bringing them in and players settling. He kind of got into it straight away, didn't he?
He did, very much so. And incredibly so, because he spoke no English. Obviously, we never had anyone at the club that spoke Russian. We managed to get hold of the interpreter. He came in to see me once with an injury and I had to phone the interpreter and we were talking three ways on the phone. Can you speak to him? And then can you tell me? And it was incredible, absolutely incredible. But football-wise, the one thing, when the players, you know, they can't speak the language and it's completely different, they haven't got their families with them, you know, it's so difficult, but you tend to find that when they get on the pitch, footballers play football and everyone understands the language of football. And when you think of all the nationalities that we've got playing at the moment, you know, the lads do so well, you know, they get in and it is difficult. I agree with Alan about the pace of the football that he's playing in. But he's now picked up that pace and his footballing brain is giving him that space that Steve was saying about. You know, that's his footballing brain doing that. But at the moment, we've got a lovely blend. And I've noticed that perhaps the constant changes have stopped slightly. And that's maybe why we're a little bit leggy at Burnley, because roughly the same group of players have been playing now, because I think we're getting the best out of them and the results have changed remarkably, haven't they?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, a settled team. I mean, at the end of the day, Malcolm, players want to know they're playing, don't they, really?
Exactly. You know, going into cricket, the Test match starting tomorrow, I can understand why they're resting James Anderson. Do you think James Anderson was to be rested? Of course he doesn't. Players want to play, you know, footballers want to play. And even if it's Mondays, you know, Saturdays, Wednesdays, Saturday, they want to play all those games. They don't want to train, they want to play.
Okay. Have you ever seen a footballer, Malcolm, that you didn't think wanted to play?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you name names?
I can't name names, but I think we could still be seeing that happening at the moment. Not at this club, but well, certainly at some clubs.
I mean, I've got to mention Paul Kitson at this point.
Well, I didn't mention any names.
we can't afford solicitors, so, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Move on with your idea, mate. Come on.
Okay, I mean, just before we go to Shirt of the Week, I mean, obviously, we're out of the FA Cup. It is a disappointment because it was a game. Actually, I think we dominated that game largely. I think we played some really, really good football. There was a lot of eye-catching performances. Karbovnik, Moda, we mentioned. Tal was. I think he should have been playing a little bit closer to Zakiri because there was at times where he would have been there for. If he was a little bit closer, there would have been a layoff and there would have been
Right, if I can throw in my two penneth about that, I think Moda has given Graham Potter food for thought. He's given him another midfield headache to consider.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had Cachido on the bench as well.
So we've got that. We've got, what was his name, Kubovnik?
Yeah.
Played reasonably well at kind of right back, a right wing back, but you can see that Beltman and Lamptey are clearly sort of like, you know, they're ahead of him in the queue. So
it's a good job he's a left back then.
Well, maybe, but
he was playing out of position and he absolutely
Yeah, but what I'm saying is he didn't let himself down, but you can see there was a certain amount of a difference in class. Zakiri looked very hungry, looked very lively. He's got, you know, sort of dancing feet. And looks, for the time being, certainly looks confident that he's going to bag a goal. And if he does, hopefully with any striker, once you bag one, you bag several.
Yeah,
I think he was trying a little bit too hard. But I think your point about playing a bit closer to him probably has some merit as well.
Erion Percy, he's a Houghton signing, isn't he? Does he fit Potter's system? Because I'm not sure in that 3-5-1-2 or 1-1 or 2. I'm not really sure where Percy Tau fits. It's a bit like your Hambach. Houghton signing, wide right player, doesn't really fit the system at the moment.
That's an interesting point, actually. And I think probably we're not going to really be able to give that a more definitive answer until we see another 3-4-5 games out of him.
Yeah, and as you said, obviously he's been in Europe, so he's been away from South Africa for a while now. But I mean, it's still a different league, and he's coming to terms with it. And the Premier League is a little bit higher standard than the Jupiler League. So, I think we will see the best of him. But again, like Alexis McAllister, just a little bit of patience is needed here.
Absolutely.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and I have a lovely shirt for you all to look at and describe for me. Where do we, Malcolm, have you got it there?
I've got a picture of it here somewhere.
Okay, describe it for me?
Oops. It's hold on a second.
I'll tell you what, Steve, you start the descriptions, mate.
Okay, so it's blue with a beautiful kind of 80s collar. The brand is Luan V. And then the most striking thing is over the left shoulder, it looks like someone has painted a red and yellow flag over the shoulder and the left arm, kind of crossing into the chest in a somewhat disgusting manner. So it looks a bit like a flag draped over the shoulder.
Yeah, that's how I'd describe it, I think. Yeah.
What about the sponsor, Malcolm?
Well, yeah, a little house on the front with CJB. And a nice little heart, too, to the right of it. So I would imagine that this is some form of builder that's sponsoring them. this is it's
everything
not something that
this,
I would go
everything
out and buy,
about this, AD.
You're sorry?
Everything about this, AD, screams Catalonia.
Yeah, I agree entirely.
Yeah, the colours certainly.
I will give you Spanish.
Okay. Oh. All right. In that case, the only other... I can only see a Catalonian flag, but go on, fire away.
Okay. Well, do you want to give us a year?
Oh, it's not 80s, though. I'm going to say mid-90s. It's always
mid-90s. Yeah, it is. It's 95.
Mid-90s,
90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, 95, 96. Yeah. Okay, and this is what Phil from oldfootballshirts.com has given us this week. And I hope, he says, I do hope your guests have guessed this one. This is the 95-96 away shirt of Spanish side Valencia. They are nicknamed Le Murciagos, which translates to be the Bats. And they play at the Mestalla Stadium, which has a capacity of 48,600. The team was formed in 1919. And the first honour was winning La Liga in 1941-42. And subsequently, they've won the league a further 5 times. 41-42 was a good season. They also won the Copa del Rey, a feat they repeated 7 more times since. And in their history, they've played 84 seasons in the top flight, La Liga, and 4 seasons in the second tier. They've added a number of European trophies to their honours list, most recently the UEFA Cup in 2003 and 2004 under the management of Rafa Benitez. The most appearances in the Valencia shirt goes to Fernando Gomez, who played 565 times for the Bats before transferring to Wolves in 98 for just one season before returning to Spain and retiring in the year 2000. Of course, there are some Brighton links. Do you want to guess them?
Bruno.
Vicente. Yeah. Spanish Dave. Was Spanish Dave there?
No. There's one more.
Matty Ryan.
Andy. Yeah, there we go.
Ryan.
Matty Ryan.
So the Brighton links, most notably, is Bruno, who made 59 La Liga appearances for Valencia between 2009 and 2012 before moving to the Albion. Matty Ryan played 21 times in Spain between 2015 and 2017. Vicente is something of a legend at Valencia, making 243 La Liga appearances between 2000 and 2011 before joining the Seagulls. You can add to the list Martin Montoya, who, after 52 games in blue and white stripes, now plays in green and white stripes with Real Betis in La Liga. But that's not
Valencia, is it? Yeah,
thanks for that.
Betis is in Seville.
Yeah, anyway.
Can I tell you, anyway, Andy, thanks. I just point out one other Valencian nickname link with the Albion. But do you accept there'll be an increased risk of vehicle back collision?
Moving swiftly on, just before we move on to a special anniversary that we're celebrating this week, we got a couple of things on the notice board.
Yes, and this hopefully is going to be right up Steve Street here, although if Mark could take a part as well, and then better still. The Athletic, the online magazine, excellent football magazine, or sports magazine generally, is hosting a series of quiz nights on Zoom. So, Malk, if you want to sign up now, then we'll start hooking you up. Yes, so it's going to be the Brighton Hove Albion Fans Night, March the 3rd on Zoom. You have to be registered with The Athletic. So if you subscribe already, just go onto The Athletic website and register to take part in the quiz. If you're not, then just go to theathletic.co.uk/AlbionRaw and you can sign up for a 30-day free trial period, which will allow you to register to take part. It's going to take part on Zoom. There's 40 questions, football questions. I suspect Albion related. I don't know. The winner of that particular quiz goes on to a grand final. To face winners of other clubs' quizzes, and the winner will receive £1,000 matched by a £1,000 donation from The Athletic to Prostate Cancer UK. So, just go to The Athletic website and register in order to take part. Steve, you up for it?
Well, I did look at it, but it's an individual one, isn't it? I can't bring my teammates, so I'm slightly concerned.
I believe you can get a team together.
No.
Can you? Yeah, I'd definitely be up for that. Okay. Then I'll do the same process as last time.
Yes,
it's individual, and it's unless you've got people in the same bubble.
The people in my bubble. Actually, my son's all right, but the rest of my bubble isn't fantastic. So
okay. Well, let's move on then. 24 years ago this week, an event happened that not only helped to save the Albion, but also put in place a network that has come to the aid of many other clubs in trouble ever since. And that, of course, was Fans United. Now, with Malcolm, you were there on the touchline that day. But can you just tell us what your memory of that were?
Do you know what? We heard all about what was going to happen, AD, and we couldn't picture what would happen. But at those times, I used to jog into the ground on the morning of the game. And I was running down and got to Hove Park and then suddenly saw these flags. And Hove Park was bedecked with flags, with people putting papers down and programs, and it was absolutely amazing. And I was going around reading all these different things from different clubs, and you suddenly realize this actually was going to be something we'd never seen before. And of course at that time we needed all the help we could get, and the fans that day took us to victory. It was an incredible day. I think on the day we were playing Hull City, if I'm correct.
Hartlepool, rather.
And I felt ever so sorry for Hartlepool because it felt as if they were taking on the world. It wasn't just their players out there. It was everybody. You couldn't go out and lose that game with all those people behind you. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible.
In the build-up to it, Malcolm, did you have any idea as to what it might be? I mean, we now look back on it now as a red letter day in the history of the Albion. And like I say, it was one of the most important games of the season, certainly, because we scored five. Mm-hmm. But did you have any inkling, even while it was going on, that this was something a bit special?
Oh, without a doubt. As I said, from the morning, just going into the ground and the atmosphere around the ground, it suddenly become a proper football club again, which it hadn't been. It had been a bit of a joke, hadn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
And suddenly we had a proper football club and the fans were in there and it was like the old days at the Goldstone. You know, as I said, you couldn't go out there that day and lose. It was fantastic. And it, not just for the Albion, but, you know, for the whole of football, because I think it brought football really together again. You know, it was incredible, absolutely incredible.
Steve, I guess that, you know, the numbers were swirled by the fact that certain Brighton fans misbehaved and opened the exit door. I mean, did you take advantage of that?
Well, no, I took advantage of something else, actually. I was fortunate enough to be a good friend of Chris Tuck, who's the brother of Stuart Tuck, who Malcolm, unfortunately, was seeing far too often at the time, or a couple of years later. You've probably seen Chris a few times as well, Malcolm, over the years.
Yes, I have.
So, yeah, I was fortunate enough to get a comp. So I wasn't too worried. I was in the West on a freebie. But, yeah, it was a bizarre day, wasn't it? And there were Southampton fans near us. And yeah. it was a strange day, but fantastic. Yeah.
Well, the thing about that was is that no one really occurred. I mean, I remember having the public meetings, or certainly the first public meeting where Dick Knight and Martin Perry introduced themselves, I think probably about 3 or 4 months beforehand. And the idea for Fans United only came about from the beginning of December with Richard Vaughan's post on the fledgling Internet Seagulls site. We were not that fussed about giving the club money. Now, obviously, the players needed paying and yourself needed paying, Malcolm, but the whole thing was that we wanted to be able to turn up, support the team, but without giving Bill Archer money. I mean, that's kind of a paradoxical thing for us to do. But, you know, quietly, there was an awful lot of support between, you know, the fans and the players as to, you know, openly and overtly, but, you know, quietly, you know, as to the whole nonsense going on at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Obviously, I was in a fortunate position. I was a fan of the club that ended up working for the club. So, you know, it wasn't lost on me what was happening. And they were very strange times. Recently, I actually, because of the lockdown, went through some old reading material and found the book Build a Bonfire.
Mm. Yeah.
Read it again, and it was incredible. Having read it, it made me realise what I'd worked through. It was incredible to work through those times. Absolutely incredible.
I mean, there you go. Watching on Super Reverb Vision, Steve has just gone to his bookshelf behind him where the Renf trophy is and fished out his copy of Build a Bonfire. Mine's here somewhere as well. And yeah, I mean, I remember being given a copy of Build a Bonfire on Christmas Day by my then partner. And most of Christmas Day, I was persona non grata because I had my head buried in this book. Such a fascinating tale, is it? But yeah, I mean, surely, well, bearing in mind he's dead, so you can say what you want. You must have wanted to thump Bellotti on a daily basis, surely, Malcolm.
Do you know what? I found that if you could smile, every time I walked past him, I made a point of smiling, and he hated it because really? he didn't want a happy ship. He wanted everyone to be horrible and miserable. So I made a great point of smiling every time I saw him. We had air moments, and he definitely wanted me out. It's something perhaps I may have told you in the past, but when we had a change of manager and Steve Gritt come in, I was a very good friend of Alan Kirbishley's, and I'd met Gritty several times with Kerbs, and I found out that Kerbs was taking the job, and in the morning, myself and George Petchu were taken into Bellotti's office, and he sat there and turned around and said, right, we've got a new manager coming in. I'm not telling you who it is. And I thought, well, it's funny because I know him. But he said, and I've told the manager that he can change any and all members of staff. So I said, fine, absolutely fine. No problem at all. So mid-afternoon, Gritty's been announced to the press. He's having a tour of the stadium. In walks Bellotti and said, I'd like you to meet the new manager. To which Gritty went, hi, Emil, how are you? I said, nice to see you, Steve. He was absolutely gutted. Because he thought, this is his time to go. I can get rid of him. And, of course, when we left, I did do an article in the paper because at the time, it was ridiculous. We were taken to meet the new chairman in Dick Knight at the training ground. We met him. We came back to the stadium to meet David Bellotti. And he said, where have you all been? We went to meet the new chairman. He said, there is no new chairman and there will not be a new chairman. Bill Archer's the chairman. We're going nowhere. And I thought, well, we've just met one who's introduced himself as the chairman. So we evidently had two chairmen at that time. And of course, the whole thing just played out. Andy Naylor done a story in the Argus. He had the story, but he said, I can't without somebody's backing. So I put my name to it and said, look, you know, here at the club, we just wish the two sides would meet, get together. The bigger thing here is the club, not people's personalities. And he thought he'd got me. He phoned Steve Britt up, who was on holiday in America, and said, I'm sacking him over it. Steve Britt said, you can't, he's a member of my staff. And what had happened, evidently, they'd sent round a paper to say that staff weren't allowed to talk to the press. And it was a memo that I hadn't seen, and certainly I hadn't signed it. And as he couldn't produce it, he couldn't sack me. So, again, you know, I just managed to sit there and smile.
Sorry, I mean, you know, lesser people than you, Malcolm. You know, lesser people...
Yeah, but Mal, we spoke to you about this last time you were on. But I mean, your history of the Albion goes back a very long time. I think it's 1979 you started with the club. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and, yeah. In empty stadiums, just like they are now.
I mean, there was a lot of managers and a lot of players that you would have worked with under that time. I mean, if you could, which player under that did you see the most in your, which one came to see you the most?
Run on the pitch most to Leon Knight, without a doubt. But he actually never ever came into the treatment room. There were certain players. Nicky Bissett was one that I felt so sorry for. Biss had his leg broken at Swindon and it caused a lot of damage. It led to other injuries. And at that time, Biss was lined up for a big move to Ipswich. You know, so he lost out on his move. He did get back and play, but was never the same player. But, you know, if you could have seen how hard he worked to get fit, and the key to him was playing in the playoff final at Wembley because it meant so much to him. He'd worked so hard for that. Unfortunately, in the end, the injuries took their toll on him and he had to retire. But, you know, he's such a good player, such a good player. And it was a horrendous and nasty tackle that caused that injury.
I mean, unfortunately. A lot of the worst injuries you see are very innocuous, of course, as well. I mean, we've just seen that happen to Son March.
That's right, yeah.
And so, I mean, that's... I mean, when you saw that, did you know what had happened to him?
I feared for Solly when I saw that. Fortunately, not quite as bad as I thought it may be. But yeah, you know, and he's been playing so well too, Solly, hasn't he? You know, been playing so well. Couldn't have been that far away from the England setup, I wouldn't have thought, the way he was playing, you know. And somebody that's played for Southgate at under 21, he seems to have a lot of faith in people he's had before. But Solly had come back from it. He's a very, very good professional. He'll come back with no problems whatsoever.
And was it the same leg that he hurt, the same knee? Because he did his ACL before, didn't he?
He has done his ACL previously, yeah. But I don't think it's the same one. I think it's the opposite leg, I believe.
Okay, so that must be a good thing, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you know, it's... well, never a good thing, but
sure.
Somebody, for instance, Nicky Forster was a player that had damaged both ACLs. He'd had both repaired.
There's one I've got to ask you. I did mention him. I just sort of blurted out his name. I mean, did you know the extent at the time of what had happened to Jim McNulty?
We didn't know fully, but unfortunately we suspected. At the time when we were on the pitch to Jim, Jim felt it was just his back that he had fell awkwardly, caught his back. That wasn't what I'd seen. I saw the impact into the back, so I was looking for an impact injury. I wanted him to go off on a stretcher, but his father, his mum, dad and girlfriend were at the game that day. And he said to me, "Mel, I don't want to go on a stretcher. Please, it'll kill me to go off on a stretcher." So we took him off the pitch, and fortunately at the time, Paul Watson, who's now at Sheffield United, was working with us. And I asked Watto to get the doc to see him immediately. Now, we were very lucky that we had a doctor and orthopaedic surgeon there. But again, Jim was making very light of the injury. But what we wouldn't do, when he was prepared to go, I wouldn't let him go until he passed urine, because my fear was that we would see blood, and it certainly was. And it was only later that night when we got the specialist to check him out and we'd had a scan done that we realised that the horrendous injury that he'd occurred. The worst injury I've ever seen. It's not a football injury, no. And completely innocuous, you know, there was no intent, completely innocuous. But fortunately for Jim, fully recovered and still playing now. You know, so, you know, again, tremendous, tremendous character, very strong character to come through that.
I mean, with that, obviously that incident happened at with Dean. We're at the Amex now. I mean, the facilities at with Dean were ramshackle at best. So
I didn't think they were that good, actually.
So, obviously you're very fully versed in the facilities that are at the Amex. So, I mean, if that sort of thing happened again, I mean, how quickly would you be able to diagnose what happened? Or would it be the same situation?
It would be exactly the same. It would have been no different. One of the things is quite funny, because there have been lots of changes since I've left the game. But one of the things that's quite strange, that in research that's been done, people are not recovering from injuries any quicker than they have done in the last 20 odd years, which seems strange with the facilities and everything and staff that you've now got. But the diagnosis is always key. We were talking earlier about the Leicester player and his ACL.
Justin.
It's not unusual for it to be picked up later, because there's probably suspecting that there was an ACL. But unfortunately, you have to wait for swelling and all to go down before you can get the scan done. And it's the scan that's confirmed it.
Okay. Okay. Another player that is of interest to the medical profession would be young Tarek Lamptey. Now, how much of his situation would you put down to growing pains, and how much of it you would put down to just him being a pocket rocket with really, really tight hamstrings?
Yeah. He is a pocket rocket, and it's very difficult for medical staff. But what I can tell you, they've got tremendous medical staff there, especially with hamstrings. You've got, on the medical side, people at Brighton are writing articles on hamstring injuries. They know how to handle him. But unfortunately, what you've got is a lad that's got very quick fibres, which give him his pace, but playing in a game where he needs endurance, and he still hasn't fully matured and grown. So there's a lot going on. There's growth going on. There's injuries, there's remoulding, and sometimes may have to remould the way that he plays the game to get through this. But he couldn't be in better hands than the medical staff they've got there.
So basically what you're saying is, when he comes back for a pre-season training next season, he's going to be 6'2".
Well, yeah, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, they've probably, it's been ideal, because they've picked up some results. So the pressure on bringing the lad back, if he were my player and the talent that he is, I would actually be looking at him coming back next season. Michael Owen was put under a lot of pressure at Liverpool against what the medical staff wanted, to come back and play because of the difference he was making to them. That ruined him, I think. You know, it didn't help him.
Okay, Steve, listen, we've only got a couple of minutes to go there, but Steve, I mean, we were talking about sort of, you know, Malcolm trying not to kill all the footballers that he's ever worked with and places like the Goldson and Withdean. And here we are, we're sort of now 10 years on from the end of Withdean. You know, we're approaching the 10th anniversary of such a good season. You know, arguably one of the best that we've ever had. So with that in mind, just for the last couple of minutes, let's hit a bit of a nostalgia thing here. What are your memories and recollections of Withdean?
The first thing that comes to mind was being stung by a wasp twice in the space of about a minute at a home game, because I was right at the very back of the stand where it feels like you're essentially in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
It was just a bizarre place, wasn't it? I remember... Are you thinking specifically that last season or generally Withdean?
Just your memories of Withdean generally. I mean, we were there for, what, 10 years, 12 years?
I mean, one of the biggest ones for me was Rochdale at home, where we lost 3-2, and I don't think I've ever been wetter in my life.
Yeah.
It was just a bizarre place to watch.
4-3, was it?
4-3, aren't they?
I think Rochdale was 3-2.
No, it was 4-3. Who's counting when you're drowning, mate?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I left. But yeah, there was some good football along the way, wasn't there? I mean, there was the Wilkins team that was really exciting with all the young kids. There was that amazing FA Cup win, 7-0, was it? There was some good moments along the way, wasn't there?
8-0.
8-1.
Well. 8, God, yeah. And then was it 8-0? And 8-0. then Russell Slade keeping us up. You know, there were some great memories.
Plus Bobby Zamora, Leon Knight, you know, Glenn Murray, Ashley Barnes.
You can't mention Leon Knight without thinking about Malcolm running on to treat him. Exactly. Not anymore, anyway.
Exactly.
But like Bobby Zamora, like flicking the ball over Chris Wilder's head to volley it into the back of the net. It was.
But he didn't quite. It was Wilder that actually. Well,
oh no, it was his name.
He tried a clearance and it just went straight up. Malcolm, what's Withdean to you, mate?
Some great memories of it. Some bad memories. Remember having to evacuate the medical room once because a rat had died under it. The smell was horrendous. I think they wouldn't be doing that at the Amex, would they?
In fact, can I just say that there, actually, again, we're on Zoom here and Aidy was taking a swig of beer as Malcolm said that. And we're taking the proverbial everywhere. Fantastic.
But yeah, it's one of the funniest memories, as you remember, when we were promoted and we were neck and neck with Chesterfield.
Yeah,
and we played them, I think, on the Wednesday. It was a Tuesday or Wednesday, and we actually guaranteed promotion that night.
Yeah,
and as we come off the pitch, we then had the dressing rooms on the bottom right hand side. We come off the pitch, and there was an altercation, and so many players went into the Chesterfield dressing room to sort it out. The floor collapsed, and there was players fell through the floor in the dressing room. It couldn't happen anywhere else, could it?
Amazing.
And that's a brilliant place to leave it. Malcolm, it's so lovely to hear your stories, and we'd love to hear some more, and I'm sure we will in a future episode.
Sure we will.
But thank you to Malcolm Stewart, to Alan Wares, to Steve Agace. I've been Aidy Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week.
Zoom, just one look, and then my heart went boom. Suddenly, and we were on the moon, flying high in a neon sky. Oh, bang, just one touch, and all the church bells rang. Heaven called, and all the angels sang. Sunrise shine in the midnight sky. Oh,
my whole wild.